Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Gary Steingart read his story, The Luck of Kokura, from the June 25th, 2018 issue of the magazine. Steingart has published three novels, including Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story, and the memoir Little Failure. His fourth novel, Lake Success, from which this story was adapted, comes out in September. Now here's Gary Steingart.
The Luck of Kokura. Barry was trying to focus, but on what? Shapes began to materialize. Circles, triangles, three panels in outrageously bright colors. It was that squiggly AIDS painter guy from the 1980s. A figure fell into his head, something he had once discussed with Seema at a gallery. 1.8 million. Okay. He was on a bed. He was hungry, but at the same time, beyond hunger. He turned his head. There were magazines displayed on a nightstand, a Bentley mag and a Patek Philippe mag and a Nat Geo. The rollerboard with his watches and Shiva's rabbit toy and his passport was neatly placed at the foot of the bed. There was also a glass coffee table topped with a bottle of Fiji water, a jar of salted almonds, and familiar-looking bars of 70% cocoa Chocolat Madagascar. Barry crawled the length of the bed to the coffee table. He began stuffing the food into his mouth, the nuts and chocolate crunching sweet and bitter over his tongue, then poured the water into his mouth. He burped ferociously, his whole being coming back to life. He had fled New York, fled his wife and his son's autism diagnosis, fled his hedge fund, this side of capital and all its troubles. Not that he had done anything wrong. Yes, his fund had shorted Gastrolux, a pharma with a new GERD reflux medication in phase 2 trial that was supposed to cure the esophageal difficulties of stressed-out yuppies belching up their Acela coffee and egg and sausage rolls. And yes, he was a major shareholder in ValuePro, which had almost bought Gastrolux and whose management knew the drug would fail. And yes, they had made about $200 million on the trade, their last really successful trade. But it had all been a great big coincidence. Everyone else had piled into that trade anyway. What proof did the feds have that he'd used his relationship with ValuePro to make money off the demise of Gastrolux? It was like the whole of society was positioned to make sure Barry didn't make money off anything. It was socialism. He didn't want Trump to win, but he was glad the Obama years were sputtering to an end, even as they coincided with his own potential demise. Barry had fled with nothing more than a Greyhound bus ticket, $600, he had had to ditch the Amex Black Card for security reasons, and his rollerboard of watches. And now he was in Atlanta, having stumbled into Jeff Park's condo straight off the Greyhound, dehydrated and barely alive. The lights and blinds were all Lutron, and a small closet concealed the obligatory Crestron rack for the audiovisuals, among scattered boxes of Lanvin sneakers. He peed his heart out into a porcelainosa. The hand soap was by Molton Brown. He was definitely off the hound and back in hedge world. The guest room, if that was what it was far better curated than the guest room Seema had put together. Jeff Park must have married well. Barry was wearing a t-shirt with the words Georgia Aquarium across the chest, along with a photograph of a whale shark. Someone had changed him out of his vineyard vines. The park wife again? Barry pressed the button to raise the blinds, and Atlanta appeared before him, the customary Wells Fargo and the BB&T tower, but also some old-fashioned RKO-style antennas and deeply undistinguished 1970s edifice that scanned as Coca-Cola HQ. He could see that the city still brimmed with underused space, acres of lots that called out for condos and hotels. Barry looked around for his sneakers, but they were not there. He had been in Asian households before and was familiar with their war on shoes. A corridor of chilled marble emptied into a huge living space, and there Barry felt a burst of old, pre-Greyhound hedge world jealousy. The living room was as palatial as the entrance to a modest New York museum. Enormous golden lights hung from the ceiling, which was at least 20 feet high. He knew the company that made them. Seema liked their work, but the high ceilings of their New York apartment were not high enough. Judging simply by the measurement of the great room, he sized the apartment at 4,500 square feet minimum. This from a guy Akash Singh had fired from this side of Capitol, a guy who had had to clear out his desk within an hour as a security guard hulked in the corner watching his every move. Barry tried to console himself with the fact that Atlanta property, even at its gilded peak, would still cost a third of what it cost in New York. Okay, let's say 4,500 square feet at 500 a foot, that would be what? Just $2 and a quarter. In New York, anything below 5 million didn't even qualify as luxury. Lost as he was in his real estate reverie, he failed to notice the sporty exhales of the property owner himself, who was performing an impressive bout of push-ups in the middle of the light-filled space. Jeff Park still had his thick Asian hair, if not more of it, and he was clothed in some kind of black athletic gear that maybe would allow for scuba diving or travel to Mars. Eventually, Jeff Park noticed his former employer casting a shadow over him. He hopped up from the floor in one youthful 30-something motion. "Barry," he said, "you're alive." Full head of hair, gums that didn't recede, push-ups in the middle of the day. Jeff Park had gone to Cornell, if Barry remembered correctly, but had not played lacrosse. A Fitz driver with good casual taste, he was to be approached just like a potential investor. Barry was ready to do a little Princeton two-step with a perfectly calibrated friend move. He shook his host's hand eagerly. "Jeff, right off the bat, thank you," he said. "You didn't have to welcome me into your home." "I'm just glad we didn't need an ambulance," Jeff Park said. "Although I did call for a house visit from my family doctor." "Cancel it," Barry said. "I'm feeling better than ever. Just low blood sugar is all. Hey, seriously, you're a peach of a guy. Where's your better half?" "Still looking for that perfect girl, I'm afraid." "Huh, and you decorated this place yourself?" "Guilty as charged. Come, let me make you a corpse reviver." They walked to an area flanked by a shelf of Ciroc bottles denoting general recreation. Jeff Park poured a glass of fizzy German mineral water. "You've got to hydrate," he ordered. "I want to see you finish this H2O before you hit the hard stuff." Jeff Park's corpse reviver was, as the name promised, a ridiculously potent blend of cognac, Calvados, and vermouth served in a martini glass. "Jesus," Barry said as he finished his drink. Some vague memories of downtown bars returned. Jeff Park could hold his own with the alcohol. "So what's up, Barry?" Jeff Park said. "Just passing through? Decided to look me up?" He had brought out a bottle of 20-year Yamazaki and was serving it straight up, quite decadent for 1:27 p.m. What the hell did Jeff Park do for a living? He had cashed out of this side of Capitol with zero. "All of this is going to sound crazy," Barry said. "Uh-huh. I'm on a journey by bus." Barry knew that he would eventually have to explain his flight from this side of Capitol to people in his bracket. He knew that news of his meltdown would immediately form the latest bulletin in the incestuous, bloodthirsty world from which he had sprung. But he doubted that it would really surprise anyone. The people in his world could be nuts. The world's largest hedge fund, Bridgewater of Westport, Connecticut, was essentially a cult with its own Bible, ritual, mind control, and feats of strength. A fellow at another fund, a quant billionaire in training, played a piano at a third-rate bar while passing around a tip jar. Like your first ankle monitor or your fourth divorce, the occasional break with reality was an important part of any hedge fund titan's biography. "The things I've seen," Barry said, and he told Jeff Park a few of his adventures so far. Jeff Park seemed interested. He poured more drinks, although he insisted that Barry chase his with water. "It sounds a little bit like you're doing a version of On the Road," Park said. "That's exactly right," Barry shouted. "That's exactly what I thought." No wonder he had picked Jeff Park to host him. The man had literary sensibility beyond those of his colleagues. They really did a good job of educating up at Cornell. "I used to take the Greyhound to visit my uncle's family in Savannah," Jeff Park said. "Everyone there looked at us like we were freaks." "Everyone looks at me like I'm a freak." "You kind of are a freak, Barry." Barry took that as the highest of compliments. He was bonding with this former employee. They were going to be friends. "Are you from around here originally?" "Yeah, I moved back down to take care of my parents." "Your parents are, I want to say, from China?" "Close enough." "My wife is Indian." "Rock. You ought to get married," Barry said, completely forgetting that his own marriage was only a team of seven lawyers short of kaput, to borrow his father's favorite word. Maybe this nice Jeff Park couldn't find a woman to marry away from New York. He had given up on finding a partner in order to take care of his parents. Immigrants. Barry wanted to tell him that his own mother had died when he was five, but they weren't there yet. He eyed his glass of Yamazaki as Atlanta blazed cruel beyond the tinted floor-to-ceiling windows. His instinct to help Jeff Park was overwhelming. He remembered Seema's friend, the Asian woman from Brooklyn, Tina, Lena. "I threw away my cell phone," Barry said. "Now that's amazing," Jeff Park said. "Can I check something on your computer?" A laptop was provided. The world of the internet was so far away from who he was at this point. Still, he brought up Seema's profile. No new posts in forever. Seema was not an avid social media person, a thing he loved about her. "Is that your wife and kid?" Jeff Park asked. The profile photo in the corner of the screen was of Seema with her arms almost around Shiva, behind them the neo-Georgian shell of the 6,000-square-foot Rhinebeck house in progress. Shiva was looking away, but in a super intelligent way, which made the whole thing look like a portrait in normalcy, maybe precocity. And anyway, Seema's best Bollywood smile lit up the landscape better than any sun. Her cleavage was open and ready and golden. "What a gorgeous family you have," Jeff Park said. "When I worked for you, I think you were just about to get married. That kid, those eyes." "Yes," Barry said, his hand frozen over the keyboard. A Sesame Street song started playing in his head. "C is for cookie, that's good enough for me." "But here's what I wanted to show you," he said. He scrolled to the list of Seema's friends. "Now, this girl is spunky," Barry said. "She called me a tool to my face, and I think she's pretty intellectual, like you. Oh, one night in Brooklyn, she made these great Chinese dumplings for us. I bet your folks would love her." "Mina Kim," Jeff Park read off the screen. "Not really up my alley." Barry was heartbroken. "But she's Chinese!" Jeff Park stared at him. "I'm more into the Southern Belle type," he finally said. "Oh," Barry sighed. "But thanks for looking out for me. You're like that woman from Fiddler on the Roof." Barry sort of knew what he was talking about. Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Jeff Park had a wide cultural reach. "Well, I'm going to make it my mission to get you married," he said. "Nice guy like you." "I'm not averse to the ladies," Jeff Park said. "I've designed this place with them in mind." "How so?" Jeff Park took him on a tour, starting with a massive glass-topped dining table. "You see these lights," he said, pointing out a trio of Sputnik-style globes hanging over the mirrored surface. "The average girl I date is 5'6", or an inch taller than the national average. I have a spreadsheet that lists the attributes of each girl I've ever dated. It's super granular. So if I'm making her dinner, and she's standing here waiting for me, talking to me, maybe having a drink, the light from these lamps is directly level with her eyes. She can see better, and I can enjoy her glow." Barry was impressed by Park's thoughtfulness. A spreadsheet? The rap on guys in finance was all wrong. They care too much. He knew he did. If you looked at it a certain way, he had abandoned his family because he didn't have the emotional bandwidth to accommodate their special needs. He examined a frigate-sized couch. "This sofa is the perfect height for a 5'6" woman," Jeff Park said. "When she sits down, the sofa waterfalls at the back of her knees." he invited Barry to sit down. You see, there's a gap of at least 3 inches between the back of your knee and the couch because you're tall. But if you were a 5'6" woman, you'd be completely snug. So you only date women of that height? Barry asked. Well, there's some variance, Jeff Park said. Maybe half a sigma. I don't want the tail wagging the dog, but yeah, mostly. You're a romantic, Barry said. Jeff Park shrugged, blushing. He was not unhandsome. His face was chiseled and tanned to a dusky perfection. The black athletic gear made him look like a glossy seal in human form. Only the Rolex Guidewheeler on his wrist did not appeal to Barry's taste. Upstairs, Park had an airy office with a full view of the awful Coca-Cola tower. Barry felt a twinge of passion at the sight of a Bloomberg up and running. Jeff Park had only one screen going, which was cute. On a glass board, he had sketched out some trades that appeared exceptionally long-term and cautious, making some kind of play around Alcoa and Dow. Just scanning the numbers on the board, Barry assumed an AUM of $35 million, which in the best of worlds brought in, what, a couple of million a year? He probably had a net of 10 to 15, and he could live on it and be happy and buy couches that waterfall the legs of near-median women. I trade maybe 2 hours in the morning, and then I spend the rest of the day working on myself, Jeff Park said, as they passed a formidable wall of books, most of them new and clearly not bought by the yard. I read at least 100 books a year, and if I'm at, let's say, 70 by November, I'll take the rest of the year off from work to catch up. I like reading books of the girls I date, Beckett plays, Chekhov stories, Shakespeare sonnets. Believe me, they need it around these parts. Wonderful, just wonderful, Barry said. This is what I'm talking about. Real self-improvement, a vocation and an avocation. So many guys say, I want to die at my peak net worth, but not me. Clearly not. Jeff now led him into a bathroom. They were looking at the double mirrors that functioned as TVs in the rain shower tub. The GOP convention in Cleveland was in full blaze. Ted Cruz was saying he would not be voting for Hillary, but he wasn't going to endorse Trump either. I used to stay at the Trump Hotel in Columbus Circle whenever I visited New York, Jeff Park said. Never again. I'm a moderate Republican, Barry said. Socially liberal. They went downstairs for a new course of drinks. Jeff Park was making them with ruby red vodka and Seagram soda now. They sat at a table made from the cross-section of a giant tree. Its height was also designed to seduce an almost average woman. Barry felt around the serrated bark of the edges. He liked furniture that was slightly rustic with hints of the arts and crafts movement. That was supposed to be the motif of the Rhinebeck house if he ever finished it. Who made this? Barry asked. The vodka and soda combination was delicious. It's a Japanese eucalyptus, Jeff Park said. I bought it in Kokura. It reminds me of how lucky I am. Kokura? You never heard of the luck of Kokura? August 9th, 1945. An American bomber was headed to bomb Kokura in the south of Japan, but there was too much cloud cover over the city that day, so the plane was diverted to Nagasaki. Wow. Lucky for sure. Right, luck. If I'd been born in Bangladesh to a family of rag pickers, would any of this happen? He swept his arm around his 4,500 square feet of property. My mother worked as a maid in Buckhead when they got here. I still remember the food stamps with the drawings of the old whitey signing the Declaration of Independence. I memorized the words on it. U.S. Department of Agriculture food coupon. Where else could a maid's son end up like this? That's why I'll always take care of my folks. Why I'll always live in the same town as them. I've got to honor the luck that was given me. Barry thought of his own relationship with his parents. He had not had the opportunity to take care of his mother, of course, but he thought he had been kind enough to his father, given everything. After he had secured his first billion under management, he had bought out his father's pool cleaning company, Malibu Pools, for $4 million, about 10 times what it was worth, so that his dad could finally retire. But after that gesture, and after his father's openly racist behavior at his and Seema's wedding, he'd mostly avoided the old man. He had gone out just once to La Jolla, California, where his father was living with his girlfriend, Netta, whom he had found in an online Zionist forum. I'm so sorry about your son getting autism, Netta had said. Did you give him vaccines? I'm sure that's what did it. I told him not to get the vaccines, his father had hollered from his perch beneath a plum tree. I sent him the links about how the Somalian Muslims were spreading it through their doctors in Minnesota. Barry was out of there in less than 36 hours. 5 months later, his father was dead of pancreatic cancer. Maybe Jeff Park was just a better son, and maybe better sons made for better people, and that was why their mothers didn't die in car accidents, their faces caked in blood. But that's not luck, Barry said, returning to the theme of the conversation. Sure, it's helpful not to be born to rag pickers, but mostly your success was a result of your own hard work and your parents' gumption to move here. You don't consider yourself lucky? Not for a minute, Barry said. You found yourself working in the right industry at the right time, no regulation, all the leverage you could eat from the banks. I'm not even going to mention the insider trading that's just part of being in the old boys' club. I don't think we're under investigation, Barry said, which was to say that the FBI hadn't bashed in their door yet. Jeff Park looked at him. What could he know? Hey, I'm not knocking what we do, Jeff Park said. It takes smarts, but so much of it is luck. You execute one good trade, and people will listen to everything you say for the next 5 years. All I know is I never had any advantages, Barry said. I wasn't even lucky enough to be born to immigrant parents. Jeff Park laughed. Now that's funny. They clinked glasses. Barry was sprawled on the guest room bed, the room spinning around him. He had found someone to talk to. The days without Seema's chatter had taken their toll, but now he had a friend again, and a friend who wouldn't talk about Shiva's diagnosis 24/7. He took off his Georgia Aquarium whale shark t-shirt and wondered if Jeff Park himself had changed him out of his vineyard vines. The intimacy would be a little shocking, but it pleased Barry nonetheless. He was fine with his body. The whole thing about luck made him wonder, though. Barry considered himself entirely self-made. His father hadn't collected food stamps like Jeff Park's parents, but he used to get all his towels cheap from a source at an upstate prison. Every raggedy towel Barry ever knew as an adolescent had been stamped with the legend Hudson Correctional Facility. It took three towels to dry off after a shower. Frugality was the motto of the two Cohen men and the depressed sheepdog in their red brick semi-detached duplex on Little Neck Parkway with its plastic chairs and the little green island of front yard and its thick security gates for the robbers who would never come. His father's business servicing Nassau County pools was seasonal, and he could never squirrel away enough for the winter. Barry's first crush must have been the blonde mermaid on the chicken of the sea tuna cans his father bought at Waldbaum's, four for a dollar. Not that Jeff Park had had great luck in life either. Just 6 months into his tenure at this side of Capitol, probably a year shy of turning 30, he had omitted a minus sign in an Excel spreadsheet and turned negative margins positive and a clear sell into a screaming buy. The trade was losing $30 million a day, and by the time he discovered the error, it was down $150 million. A simple error had cost the fund close to 10% of AUM. Barry hadn't been there for the actual moment, but he'd heard that when Jeff Park had realized what was happening, he passed out, smashing his head right into a Starbucks on his desk. He'd had to be taken to the hospital with light burns and a moderate concussion. The hit to his reputation was even worse, and rumors soon spread that he was selling real estate down in Florida. Beyond the actual loss of money, it was a sad story, although it cracked some people up. Akash Singh wasn't one of them. He said he had never expected such negligence from an Asian. And now Barry was lying around in Jeff Park's guest bed in his underwear. There was a knock on his door. Yeah, Barry shouted. What's up? Jeff Park wanted him to know that they'd leave for dinner at 7. Can't wait, Barry shouted back, and he meant it. Hotlanta, as some Atlantans unironically called it, was pretty incredible. They tooled around in Jeff Park's Ferrari, California, simple working-class people on street corners calling out their love for the car or whistling at it as Manhattan construction workers would at a curvy woman. Uh-huh, they said, thrusting their hips. The Ferrari felt a bit much, as though Jeff Park hadn't got the 0.1 percenter's memo about experiences, not objects, being the shit. But then again, Barry collected watches, so who was he to talk? Over time, the ceramic brakes on Jeff Park's Ferrari had started failing from the lack of excessive speed, and the only solution, Park said his dealer had told him, was to go at least 80 miles per hour on an off-ramp and then brake like crazy. The thrust of speed and then its abrupt demise thrilled Barry. This is like astronaut training, he said. They were driving around hipster neighborhoods, passing acre upon acre of craftsman bungalows, some perched on little hills, other flush with the sidewalk, all with some kind of colorful expression of their owner's taste, an applique of a butterfly on the front porch, or the hulk of some magnificent 70s vehicle idling by the curb in a state of tasteful neglect. Jeff Park explained that this neighborhood was called the Old Fourth Ward, and that the music they were listening to was by Outkast. Until his Greyhound trip, Barry had mostly heard this kind of music at his buddy's daughter's $500,000 bat mitzvahs at the Mandarin. This is fun, he said. The restaurant they went to for dinner was outfitted with a bunch of hunting trophies along the walls, deer mostly, but also a cow and something that might have been an impala. "I like Hemingway," Barry said. "One of my life goals is to learn to hunt like him." There were jars of pickled stuff too, okra and string beans. "So I've developed a spreadsheet on the best restaurants in Atlanta, and this place is number 17, Jeff Park said. For someone whose career had almost been done in by a spreadsheet, Jeff Park certainly set store by them. Maybe this was his attempt at Excel redemption. "The food is great, but I had to take off points for the service," he said. "I've been on the Greyhound for days," Barry said. "I've survived on pork rinds and off-brand coffee." "It's like you're suffering for all of us," Jeff Park said. Barry wondered whether many Chinese people were Christians. The food, salad garnished with buttermilk dressing, bacon and potato, catfish sausage with fermented lemon, practically gleamed on the tableware and tasted both Southern and progressive. He couldn't have been happier. They had ordered the most expensive wine on the menu, a $136 blend of Grenache and Syrah from God knows where, which both of them deemed acceptable, if a little aggressive. Barry wanted a second bottle, but he knew that he had to pay for the meal, and his $600 wouldn't go far. The bill came to $300, or half Barry's new net worth. "This place is moving up two spots on my spreadsheet," Jeff Park said, "although maybe it's just the company." He smiled at Barry. Barry could feel himself blushing. In Arab countries, you were allowed to hold a male friend's hand. He had learned that from one of his investors, Qatari Ahmed, during a very long and confusing night of drinking at the St. Regis. "Let's put on more of that outcast music," he said when they got back in the Ferrari. "It's very smart." They drove to a mall in a former industrial building called Ponce City Market, which was like the Chelsea Market in New York, only it was in Atlanta. They climbed up the elevated tracks to a new park called the Beltline, which was just like the High Line in New York, only it was also in Atlanta. As they started down the rail bed, two women with thick Southern accents asked Jeff Park to take a photograph of them with their phone. He said he'd be delighted, his own accent reverting to what it must have been before Cornell sanded off the edges. The women wore very little and were almost beautiful. One of them, a tall blonde, had a cast on her leg, which was attractive for reasons Barry couldn't fathom. The other one was younger and had a goofy smile. "Now, the one with the cast, she's a classic example of the Southern Belle," Jeff Park said after the women had moved on. "That's your type," Barry said. "Should we go back after them? You could offer them a ride in your car. They would love that." Jeff Park shrugged. "I don't know," he said. "Probably not." The sun was setting and the humidity was unpleasant, but Barry wanted to walk deeply into the night. There were trees and grass all around them, and sometimes a clump of skyline would come into view. Barry had counted at least three skylines in Atlanta already. "So," Jeff Park said, "a part of me has to ask, and I know this may not be your favorite topic." "Ask away," Barry said. "What the hell happened with ValuePro?" "Oh," Barry said, "that." ValuePro, RIP, was a pharmaceutical company that Barry had fallen in love with many years ago, in fact, right after Jeff Park was canned. He wasn't the only one, of course. Half the hedgies he knew had gone nuts for it. But Barry's erection was more pointed than the others, and it entailed at one point about half his book. ValuePro had promised value, or per its name, value, V-A-L-U, but not to its customers, who would see their pharmacy bills explode if they happened to be ill with some exotic but deadly disease of the tailbone or pudenda. No, the company promised mad value to its shareholders, and the phrase shareholder value was Barry's favorite. "We are a nation of shareholders," he had said more than once to Seema, while trying to articulate his brand of no-nonsense but compassionate capitalism. Several times during his Greyhound trip, Barry had paused to consider that, although he loved his fellow passengers deeply, he could not trust them at the voting booth because they were not shareholders. They did not understand the thrill and the pain and the obligation of owning a part of their country. In any case, ValuePro was run by a charming alcoholic nebbish named Sammy Yuntif. Yuntif wore triple-thick glasses and not so much cargo shorts as cargo pants and cargo shirts, the better to hide his pouches of fat. He twitched a lot and came across as the bad-breath chemistry teacher you sort of had to love back in high school if you were at all generous with your teenage heart. "You're a smart guy," Sammy Yuntif had mouth-breathed the first time he met Barry. "You know value." Barry hadn't been called smart since high school. He was intrigued and wanted to hear about ValuePro's business model. "Here's our business model," Yuntif said. Fuck R&D. Fuck it. We're not going to cure cancer. We're not going to save the world. We're going to deliver value to investors like you. Delivering value meant buying foreign drug companies for cheap and then using them for tax inversion purposes. Barry loved this part. His hatred of our nation's tax regime was absolute. Why not pay taxes in Ireland instead? Why pay taxes at all? He adored how little Yuntif cared about appearances. This fat, fiery Rutgers graduated nebbish in a cargo shirt who would probably have been forced to hang himself at Princeton. Barry and Seema and Yuntif and Yuntif's sumptuous Seema-grade Croatian girlfriend had whiled away 3 days together on a yacht off the coast of Sardinia. The Nebbish and the Croat spend their time drinking caseloads of Prosecco and amiably throwing up starboard. Seema, pregnant with Shiva, was not amused and at one point demanded that a helicopter evacuate her from the carnage. "This is a business of relationships," Barry kept whispering to her. ValuePro's value rocketed through the rest of the summer. Qatari Ahmed, Barry's chief investor, looked ready to give him a serious BJ. And then it all went to shit. Someone squealed. Most of the profits had come from buying other companies and then using every accounting method known to man. The media and the politicians pounced on the way that ValuePro had hiked up prices on some life-saving diuretic or whatnot. And the next thing Barry knew, his fiery, nebbish friend had checked into a rehab with a $15 million severance package. Barry wanted to stand by his friend, this guy who had accomplished so much with, socially speaking, so little. He held tight to his position, and a month later, the stock had plunged from 500 to 50. Another month later, there was no stock. "I would never trade ValuePro," Jeff Park said. "There was a lot of hair on that company. In fact, to be honest, I shorted it." "Oh," Barry said, "I thought all your trades were long-term." "I couldn't help myself. That was low-hanging fruit. It was the opposite of value investing." "Don't get all Warren Buffett on me," Barry said. The men walked along in silence. They were in a deeply forested part of the Beltline, where the sounds and circumstances of city life were few, and for a second Barry felt that they had left humanity entirely. "Can I offer you just one piece of advice?" Barry said. "As an older person," he knew the Chinese revered their elders. Wasn't that why Jeff Park had moved down to this semi-suburban city to be with his parents? "You can get a better watch than a Rolex. That's not the image someone as smart as you wants to project." Jeff Park laughed. "Ouch," he said. "I guess I struck a nerve with ValuePro. I'm sorry, man." "You know what a Veblen good is?" Barry asked. "Sure." That was too bad, as Barry longed to explain it to him. Why was it so hard to mentor this slender young man? "All I'm saying is that you should be projecting your taste to others of your stature, not to a southern belle in a leg cast." "What's on your wrist?" Jeff Park asked. "This is an F.P. Journe Octa Automatique Lune. Journe makes 900 watches a year. Rolex makes close to 1 million. Jeff Park held Barry's hand by the wrist and examined the watch. His hand was warm and dry, just like Seema's. "I like how the yellow gold hour and minute dials are lost in all the negative space around them," he said. "That's very cool." "Thanks," Barry said. He smiled. "You have very promising aesthetics." "But the southern belles we just saw, they would know exactly what a Rolex is, but they would have no idea about your watch. They might even think you bought it at the airport. A Rolex of this size and weight merely announces the scale of my ambitions. I want to represent my value." "But you must also own a Patek. You get their magazine." "I got a 1518 Perpetual in rose gold." "Wow!" Barry sighed. That rare watch was probably worth as much as Jeff Park's Hotlanta apartment. He wanted to feel good for this young man who was helping him out so much just when he needed it. Instead, he felt envious. No angry wife, no autistic child, no possible subpoena, no Wells notice on the horizon. Just two good cars, a seven-figure watch, and time to read as many books as he pleased. "I have a different takeaway from the ValuePro story," Jeff Park said. They were circling back to the former industrial building that now served as a mall. "You try to make a friend, and that friend turned out to be a bad person. And when he fell, you stood by him." "Yeah, but that's the kind of life lesson I should have learned by high school," Barry said. "Believe me, you're not as stunted as some of the other people I've met over the years." "Thank you," Barry said. I appreciate that." The Ferrari was parked in a special VIP zone, and now a young man ran to retrieve it. "Do you want to try that 1518 on for me tomorrow?" Barry asked. "I'd love to see it in the metal." Several happy days ensued. Barry enjoyed sharing his timepieces with Jeff Park, and the Patek 1518 in rose gold was indeed sumptuous. The date and month were in French, and the moon phase glowed so brightly it looked like the first drawing executed by a perfect child. Jeff Park also kept a watch log in the form of an Excel spreadsheet, and he and Barry spent a morning poring over each other's results. Barry wanted to stay at Jeff Park's just a little shy of forever, but it was a question of money. One more meal like the $300 one they had had would ruin him. He looked up some of this side of Capital's position on the Bloomberg. It was a massacre. How much of a dent would this shit make in his own net worth? Dudes who were about to belly flop often signed everything over to their wives, but he couldn't do that if he was going to divorce his. Jeff Park had lent him his other car, which was a Bentley, informing him that the rich interior leather had cost the lives of 6 cows. The whole thing smelled like a feedlot, and the worst of it was that it did maybe 9 miles to the gallon, so that Barry had to shell out $40 at a Sunoco. Thank God for cheap gas. On the other hand, wherever he parked in Atlanta, a young man would run out and say something complimentary about the car before slotting it in the VIP section right out front. He wondered what it would take to become Jeff Park's mentor again. He would sometimes get out his Patek 570 and trace the leader of men engraving with his fingertip. Maybe some of the guys at this side of Capitol did still believe in him, despite the Value Pro fiasco. He had come of age with them at Goldman, then plucked them off to form a team at Joey Goldman's Icarus Capital years before he spun off this side of Capitol. They would eat together, go to the gym together, vacation together, and also indulge their carnal sides together. At Icarus, Joey Goldblatt used to keep a map of Manhattan with all the rub-and-tug joints clearly marked. The guys did a lot of business over at Flashdancers, and Barry was not immune to the delights of a truly dirty lap dance. He was single back then, after all. But he dreaded the rub-and-tug joints. There was one night in particular when he found himself with his team in Oriental Touch, or Soul Cycle, S-E-O-U-L. The dinginess of the place shattered him. There was a decoration of some kind of Asian bird, a crane stenciled cheaply over a body of water, and a Korean air calendar. The airline calendar was especially depressing because it made him think that these girls really wanted to go home to their families. He didn't remember the face of the woman he was assigned. She was mostly eye makeup, but he couldn't have a physical encounter with her. Instead, they lay on a bunch of towels on a mattress in their underwear, looking out onto an air shaft. They talked about art history, which the woman had been studying at one of Seoul's lesser universities. She made it clear that if you weren't on the A-team in Korea, you ended up here. She asked him which part of finance he worked in. She got a lot of guys from the European banks. She advised him to collect the works of Yayoi Kusama, a Japanese artist Joey Goldblatt was oddly enough wild about. He must have gone there a lot. The allotted 60 minutes expired chastely. It was painfully clear how much this woman didn't want to have sex with him. This just wasn't how he pictured free markets. He tried not to hear his boys climaxing in the neighboring rooms, especially Akash Singh, who was very, very loud. The next day, he gathered his team and told them he didn't think that going to these kinds of places was good for them. They were going to conquer the world. One day, they'd each have AUMs of more than $10 billion. They didn't need dirty brothels. His boys were mostly a bunch of lax bros from Duke and Cornell with a smattering of friendly Princetonian overlords in training and 2 Indians from Caltech. He was at best 5 years their senior, but that counted for a lot when you were as young as they were. The boys heeded his call, and many began to explore the world of artisanal hookers and the burgeoning new pay-for-play field of online sugar daddy. Over the years, Barry took his capacity as a moralizer seriously, steering his boys away from paid girlfriends and into the world of watch collecting and moderate Republican politics. He encouraged them to date ladies from good women's colleges and acted as something of a matchmaker, even as his own bed lay cold. By the time he formed this side of Capitol, all the boys were married except for the incorrigible Akash Singh. On the first anniversary of the launch of his hedge fund, a week after the Qatar Investment Authority signed on and their AUM topped $2 billion, the boys all came together to give him the classy Patek Calatrava with the engraving he now saw before him. Until Shiva was born, it was the proudest day of his life. It would be funny to just go to Buckhead, Jeff Park said, on the night that Trump was scheduled to speak at the convention. See the rich crackers get jiggy with the GOP. They drove around Buckhead in the Ferrari California, listening to Outkast's I'm Sorry, Miss Jackson song. On a busy avenue, they parked in front of the beer curb, where there was a sign prohibiting hoods, baggy clothes, and pants below the waist. "Looks racist enough," Jeff Park said. Barry laughed, feeling high on the complicity. Could he have imagined doing something like this just last week when he was still the chief desk jockey at his office? The bar was kind of a dive, and per the prohibitions outside, entirely white. There were white men of all ages here, some dressed in pink shirts like private equity guys, others in baseball caps and lumpy denim jeans or dickies. Some had brought their women who all looked like the same woman, highlighted and nondescript. "Here's to diversity," Jeff Park said, and they clinked Miller Lights. Barry throttled his down. "I'm drinking a Miller Light." The barmaid was in her 20s, and she was gorgeous in a way that suggested maybe she hadn't been fully apprised of just how gorgeous she was. She had eyes darker than the delicious Maker's Mark chocolates Barry had found in Jeff Park's fridge, and her skin was as olive as Barry's. "So who are you voting for?" Jeff Park asked her, his shiny Rolex Sky Dweller lighting up a patch of bar around him. The barmaid opened her gorgeous mouth. Barry thought he knew what her answer would be, but he was wrong. "I despise Hillary Clinton," she said. "I just don't trust her." "But come on," Jeff Park said. "Trump?" "Socially, I'm a bit more liberal," she said, "but Trump's going to rebuild the economy to where it should be. The condos around here aren't being built fast enough under Obama." Barry thought that was an odd thing to say. It wasn't like she was going to Emory or anything. She was a bartender at a lousy bar. Barry was as trickle-down as any guy, but what did the building of Buckhead condos have to do with her lot in life? A filthy old homeless guy walked into the bar and said something in Spanish to the barmaid. He gave her a pair of sunglasses he had apparently found in the parking lot. "You want water or a Coke?" she asked him. "Coke," he rasped, and then made a smoking motion with his hand. She produced a handful of cigarettes. He stood there for a good 5 minutes, savoring his free Coke, each sip punctuated by a burp that made his eyeballs tremble, then lit up a cigarette with a wet book of matches that took another 5 minutes to spark. "That was very nice of you," Jeff Park said to the barmaid. "Eduardo comes in here all the time," she said. "He used to sweep up all the bars in Buckhead, and people took care of him. Now it's just me." "See," Barry said to Jeff Park, "this is the thing about America. You can never guess who's going to turn out to be a nice person." They asked if there was anything to eat, and the barmaid gave them a Domino's pizza menu. "You got to try the Philly cheesesteak pizza," she said. "I could eat it every night." Most of the young people in the bar were talking about sports and their own bygone athleticism, but then a trio of pink shirts came in from the heat and clustered around Barry and Jeff Park. "Can you believe this election?" Jeff Park asked them. He wasn't shy in talking to people at all. Did that come naturally, or had he spent his childhood practicing his friend moves? A Chinese dude in the South, it must have been hard. "Trump's going to win by a landslide," the leader of the pink shirt said. He was the kind of guy Barry had gone to college with, only Georgian. "Everyone knows Hillary's a liar. The folks up in Ohio and Pennsylvania, they sure know." "I agree completely," Barry said. "Lower taxes and less regulation, that's my middle name. I voted only Republican since I was 18. I think Obama's been a nightmare for this country. But I'm from New York, and honestly, Trump scares me." As soon as Barry had said the last sentence, the pink shirts turned around in unison and left the bar. They just walked right out of the place without a word. "Nice going," Jeff Park said. "You scared away the Trump youth." "I've never had people walk out on me," Barry said. "They say I'm the friendliest guy in the street." "Maybe don't announce that you're from New York and scared of Trump all in one go." Jeff Park looked flirtatiously at the barmaid who slapped him with two more Miller Lights. The Domino's Philly cheesesteak pizza arrived via a gray-haired black gentleman who had difficulty breathing. Barry dug into it with the same insatiable hunger he now brought to the rest of his life. His mouth these days was mostly about salt. Trump came on the screen. "I humbly and gratefully accept," he said. A bunch of college-age Republican boy hipsters had gathered around Barry and Jeff Park to cheer on their nominee. They all had thick beards and were going bald. Barry was scared to say anything lest they, too, walked out on him. "I'm not voting for Hillary," one of them said to Jeff Park, who was gently teasing their opinions out of them. "It has nothing to do with her being a woman. It's just that she's proven she can't run the country." "That sounds like it has a lot to do with her being a woman," Jeff Park said. When Trump mentioned his support of our greatest ally in the region, the State of Israel, the most bearded of the Trump boys said sarcastically, "Well, that just got you some votes." And the rest of his cohort laughed. Who were these people, Barry wondered. These barmaids who gave free Cokes to iterant Mexicans but wanted to vote for a man who would make fun of his disabled Indian son. The convention ended, and the hipster Trump supporters left to turn it up a notch elsewhere. Barry drank, feeling sad. The bar was now filled with guys in cargo shirts holding their beers at weird angles and girls in Daisy Dukes. A giant roach crawled by. This part of Buckhead was somehow at once wealthy and down at the heels. The band looked like the two hairy white guys from ZZ Top. They were singing a rocked-out version of Miss Jackson. First Melania cribs Michelle Obama speech, Jeff Park said. Now this. Once again, Barry felt a generalized boredom around him. The boredom of a martial country without a proper war. Wasn't that what Trump was promising his followers? An all-out conflict of their own choosing? I'm depressed, Barry admitted. Let's go back to my place and get some drink on, Jeff Park said. They walked out into the night, which smelled of pizza and gasoline. When they got to the Ferrari, a drunken bro in a backward cap stumbled up to them. I'll give you $40 for a spin around the block, he said to Jeff Park. His Southern Belle girlfriend made pigeon-like noises behind him. The guy actually took out two 20s. Jeff Park smiled sadly and shook his head. I don't need it, he said. I can see that, the drunk bro said, nodding at the Ferrari. Barry and Jeff revved off toward Midtown. Jeff Park was silent. You okay? Barry asked. That guy didn't even care about ogling my car in front of his girlfriend. I wasn't a threat to him because I'm an Asian man. It took a while for Barry to unpack that statement. In this town, you're either black or you're white, Jeff Park said. Barry said some positive things about the inherent masculinity of Jeff Park in his automobile. He didn't get a response for a while. The top on this thing used to go down in 14 seconds, Jeff Park finally said, but now it takes 18. Everything's a scam. Barry burped some Domino's and beer and then reached over and put his hand on Jeff Park's shoulder. He wanted to add, it's going to be okay, but decided to let the gesture speak for itself. Jeff Park's shoulder moved unsubtly beneath his hand, the linen of his shirt slipping out of Barry's grasp. Barry should have tried to give a friendly, athletic shoulder massage, just like the guys at the office used to do, partly for laughs and partly because it felt good. But now it was too late. They drove the rest of the way in silence. Back in the apartment, Barry pulled out some glasses and whiskey at the alcohol station to make them both something to wash out that Miller Lite taste. You go ahead, Jeff Park said. I think I'm going to turn in for the night. You sure? Gentex announces pre-market, my biggest position. Been long all month. In his bed, Barry breathed hard, sniffing up the sweet alcohol of the Yamazaki in front of him. Fuck it! Fuck it! Fuck it! What had he done? But maybe it wasn't the hand-on-shoulder gesture. Maybe it was the earlier stuff about the guy in the baseball cap trying to get a spin in his Ferrari for $40. Barry kept reconstructing the timeline over and over again. Ahmed had put his hand on his shoulder so many times. It really didn't mean anything. It really didn't. Nothing at all. He just liked being close to his friend. It was early morning, raining. The spires and crenellations of the Midtown buildings had taken on a gothic cast in the gloom. Barry carried his sorrow before him. So I think it's time for me to shove off, he said. It's time to get back on the hound. Jeff Park was eating nuts for breakfast and sipping on a macchiato. Okay, he said. Barry sat himself up on the counter. This is going to sound embarrassing, he said. Jeff Park audibly swallowed a nut. I'm going to need a tiny bridge loan. I don't have access to my funds at the moment. Maybe 2,000? I can't do that, Barry, Jeff Park said. That hurt Barry right away. Why not? You've accommodated me for this long. This is just a loan. You're welcome to my house, always, but I can't stake you. Who's talking steak? $2,000, that's 4% of the cost of your sky dweller. I feel like I'm getting mixed signals from you. Jeff Park looked down at his lap. You fired me, Barry, he said. Ah, so there it was, finally. It wasn't me, Barry said. It was Akash Singh. Everything at that place happens because of fucking Akash Singh. You were there. You invited me out to breakfast at Casa Lever, and when I got there, it was just you and the lawyer. What did the lawyer say? I'm afraid we're going to have to part ways. But that's how it's done. That's just the legal way. You didn't say one word. I wasn't allowed to say one word. And I thought of you as something like a mentor almost. Barry sighed. I'm sorry, he said. It was nothing personal. I wanted to be a mentor. I know, Jeff Park said. I fucked up. I still have dreams about that Excel sheet. I'm not making excuses, and this is nothing personal either. I like you, Barry. Their eyes locked until Barry had to look away. I'm in genuine pain, Barry said. So much of the time. Doesn't that deserve something? Attention must be paid, Jeff Park said. What? Death of a salesman. Not right now, Barry said. I wish you had been straight with me, Jeff Park said. What do you mean? You don't have any credit cards. You don't have a cell phone. You travel on a bus where you can pay for the tickets in cash. Is it that Gastrolux trade? I mean, have you been subpoenaed? Did you get your Wells notice yet? That's not why. Barry wanted to cry. I didn't do anything wrong. He thought briefly, angrily, about that yacht off Sardinia, the Nebish, the fucking Nebish from Value Pro. It all led back to him. But even if the Nebish had said something and then Barry's fund had traded on that material, non-public information, where was the proof? So many funds had shorted Gastrolux. It was the most shortable stock ever. It's a witch hunt, Barry said. They're after anyone who makes money, anyone who has friends. I'm not blameless, Jeff Park said, but I have my limits, and I know who I am. See, Barry said, that's what I'm trying to find out on this journey. Sure, Jeff Park said. And then when it's over, you can tell people about it. I'm sorry? You can tell them the story of how you once took a bus across the country. You can tell them about your journey. The Bentley entered the exciting world of Atlanta's downtown. They passed Red Eye Bail Bonds and the Atlanta DUI Academy. A group of men had gathered outside the bus station. Be careful, Jeff Park said. This bus station has a bit of a reputation. The men outside were whooping it up about the car. Bentley! They shouted. I hope you find your Southern Belle, Barry said. Jeff Park stuck out his hand, and Barry shook it. You're going to turn out better than me, Barry said. He grabbed his rollerboard and got out of the car before Jeff Park could say goodbye.
That was Gary Steingart reading his story, The Luck of Kokura. He's been publishing fiction and nonfiction in The New Yorker since 2002. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, A.M. Holmes reads Stone Mattress by Margaret Atwood. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice in Apple Podcasts on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.